Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we just watched Season 2, Episode 6, titled The Old Gods and the New. I thought this was a pretty good episode.
This was a pretty good episode myself.
Right? Okay, this is our first encounter with the wildlings in their home territory. It was interesting to see, I guess, an episode where Asha was featured in it as well.
Yeah.
So we can kind of get a little bit more where she's coming from. I thought that was pretty interesting. And there's just a lot of good stuff around, like, the tension of this guy returning home and, you know, being just a real shit to all the people there who were his brothers and his family for so many years. And he returns trying to prove himself. And I think he makes a mess of things, but we'll see.
Yeah, I like that. Like you said, the first meeting of the wildlings after hearing so much about them was interesting. I thought the scuffle in the streets of King's Landing was really well done too, and a nice little action piece and a good character moment for some people who haven't really gotten character moments or many of them thus far.
Mm-hmm.
And continuing to see the relationship between like Arya and Tywin and Jaqen's little miracle that he worked taking Amory Lorch down was really good. So I feel like that this still is got the feel of a setting, you know, moving pieces around for a an ultimate conflict, but it had a little bit more action and some nice character introductions, and that's what elevated above slightly last week, which again, not a terrible episode.
Sure. Anything else to say about it, or should we get to the recap?
Well, one thing I want to say is rest in peace to Roy Dotrice. I got lots of emails saying that I killed Roy by...
You did. You did. It's unfortunate, but you did.
It's surreal, because when I woke up, it was like, you know, one of the first things I do is I have a news aggregator, and I start scrolling through it, and because of my interest, that was towards the top, and I'm like, holy shit, I just mentioned this guy, And his importance to Game of Thrones, and express skepticism about him being able to make it through to the end of, and then like, I felt like I had the power of life and death.
I mean, not to make light of it, you know, but the guy was 94 years old. He lived a very long
and accomplished,
very industrious life.
I read his biography. He was the husband of one woman. She died in 2006. He did not remarry. He's got three daughters. He's been...
Really? He was 80 and he didn't remarry?
I mean...
Is he really living his life to the fullest?
I think he would say yes. You know, he's waiting... Well, anyway. You know, my tendency is always to turn things into joke, and the more I'm uncomfortable and awkward about it, the stronger that tendency gets, and it gets me in trouble sometimes. Hopefully not today.
But
he seemed like a really cool guy. Like I did not recognize that he. I loved the film Amadeus. He played Wolfgang Mozart's father.
Okay.
I was just reading through, like, looking for roles that I recognized him in. He had a really long and successful career, and it seemed like he was a very fulfilled guy. So, don't feel bad for him, Valor Morghulis and all that. But you know, we'll miss you in Winds and Dream for sure.
We will. I don't know who can possibly replace him.
Yeah. It's going to like I yeah it's really weird. Again, this is Game of Thrones continues to break norms. I've never heard of a situation where like in a book series our author gets switched in the middle of it, or a narrator rather. It seems like they kind of keep those consistent, but we'll miss him, and
we will.
First casualty of Winds of Winter.
He won't be the last, judging by this episode though.
No.
It's a lot of people dying in Game of Thrones.
Before we get into the episode proper, and oh god, I'm coming out of a death dedication. I feel like Casey Kasem. Like I got to do this upbeat promo.
Yeah, now you got to go into Ace of Base. All that she wants.
I'm trying to promo Bald Move out of a goddamn death dedication. God, so yeah. Moving on to happier news, we've had this secret project we've been working on the past month. We recorded a podcast for all of the episodes for Stranger Things on Netflix Season 1 to get ready to do coverage for Season 2. And we released all 8 of those things out on Monday. They're nice and snappy. There's no feedback. It's a great way for you to catch up to the series and be all ready to go for season 2, which drops next weekend. We're going to have the preview podcast for season 2 this Friday. So if you'd like to send in some feedback to that, listen to the podcast at StrangerThings@BaldMove.com. Also, we started Mr. Robot coverage of season 3 last week. Also, we're starting coverage of Walking Dead season 8 this weekend. And if you're a longtime listener, you know that for club members, we do a live watch where we watch The Walking Dead with cameras on us, and there's a way to sync up the feed so you can watch us live, and we kind of do a Mystery Science Theater 3000 type of deal for club members. Speaking of club members, we also have the next chapter of The Wolf Among Us, the Telltale video game series that we do a monthly Let's Play through. I think that's all of the stuff. We have a first-run Bald movie next week, Suburbicon, the George Clooney-directed, Coen Brothers-written, Matt Damon-starring, 50s era. I don't know what the hell it is, but those names alone attached have me intrigued. That's what's going on at BaldMove.com. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Okay, let's get into the recap.
Yes, let's do.
We start off in Winterfell. It's under attack by Theon, and Maester Luwin is scrambling to fire off a raven before he's captured, and he does that. And then Theon tells Bran, look, I've taken your castle. Bran refuses to yield, but then Theon sort of talks to him like a child here. It's really patronizing.
You have no
gross
chance. Make your time.
I guess so. He eventually convinces Bran to yield. And I guess the people outside are a little more stubborn, including Roderick, who is dragged in and insults him by spitting in his face. Mm-hmm. And his men demand that he kill him, so he goes through with it over everyone else's protests.
Yeah, it's a hell of a scene. You know, starts with the Maester Luwin barely getting the Raven off to Rob. We see up jumped Prince Theon taking the castle. It's open question whether his heart's still in it, because there's a lots here where it just doesn't seem like. I have a feeling that Theon feels like a man in a dream, where he's going through these motions and he doesn't understand why. Like, he wishes he could stop, but he can't.
Yeah, there are several moments in there where he reconsidered his plan.
Yeah.
He thinks about, is this really what I want to do? And it always comes back to him trying to prove himself to his family, trying to become Ironborn in the way that his family would have him be. And it's unfortunate because he's stuck between two families here.
Right. And it shows, it just really sells the betrayal, like, in several different ways. You have Sir Roderick, who's spitting in his face and said, I should have put that sword in your belly instead of your hand. But then you got Bran, who just like, why? You know, like, he can't even grasp that, like, my brother sent you away to get help, and now you're taking my home. Like, and both ways are equally effective, showing there's just a confusion and pain and disbelief versus the surly, anger at the betrayal. I thought it was great. And also, it's a good character moment for Theon, whose adoptive father, Eddard, taught him to demand his pass the sentence.
AKA swing Ned. I mean, holy shit, this guy. So many names.
Yeah, right? that he's got to cut his head off, and he's not very good at it.
No, he needs a bigger sword.
He needs ice or something, or maybe sharpen that thing. Maybe
or
Sir
bigger
Roderick,
arms.
Maybe Sir Roderick told him taught him wrong.
Maybe that was Roderick's point. Like, look, my neck is so thick.
Right.
You're going to look real dumb trying to slice through my neck.
Hey, the Iron Price, try the boiled leather price, you pup. And I don't know who this actor is that played Sir Roderick, but Jesus Christ, he's playing it fierce. Like, he's in full snarl until, like, everyone's losing their shit right before Theon kills him. He looks back at Bran and says, don't mind, I'm going off to see your dad, which I don't know whether I'm just super tired and out of my element when I watched this morning, but that actually briefly choked me up. Like, what the fuck? What the fuck, Sir Roderick? You got me. I have my guard down.
Not exactly the most familiar or beloved of characters, but okay.
I mean, I guess it's just that's heroism defined. Like, you're about to... Now, obviously, I think he truly believes in what he's saying, that he's going off to see his father, but, like, in your last moment, you're trying to comfort a child.
And I wonder, is he also trying to send a message to the people to resist? You know, like, I'm going to be the example. I'm going to be the martyr here.
He's Keith Olbermaning it.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know what Keith Olbermann has to do with this, but all right.
Resist. It sure as hell wasn't a clean death, though.
No. He had to kick the head off of Roderick.
Yeah, that was fucking brutal. And he Obi-Wan'd him, too, in between Olbermaning. He said, now you're truly lost.
Yeah.
It's a great scene. It's a great scene, and it really felt it in my guts.
Yep. So they march off to find the Wildling scouts up north. The Half-Hand is educating Jon on the Wildling's prowess in that area and talks about the thankless job they have of fighting a war against an enemy they can never defeat and that they'll never be recognized for. They won't even know your name.
It's a complex scene because Corrin, it's the way I read it, is he is building. He demonstrates Jon's complete naivete and inexperience.
Mm-hmm.
Then he uses like bullshit to build him up, and as it starts to work, he then tears him down right again. It's like, I can't believe, like, all this shit that I'm talking about the nobility of sacrifice. You're still too dumb, kid. Like,
yeah, I feel like he's trying to perform a reset on John's thinking here.
No, totally.
Like, he's trying to blank slate him to just confuse him so that he can then put the ideas of the Night's Watch truly into his head.
Right.
Build him up from the ground. And, yeah, it's effective because I was just as thrown as John in a lot of these instances.
Because he's like, I don't know if I should agree, if I should agree with this guy or not, because every single time he starts, like, preaching the gospel of the Black Brothers, he then...
Right.
Derisively turns it on his head. It's like, nothing. It's very kind of nihilist, which I guess if you're doing this, you know, suicide rear guard mission you kind of need to instill in your men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt like a almost a Full Metal Jacket boot camp mm-hmm. scene
right
here.
This like, is war. Stop.
This is Corrin doing his best Arlie Ermey, like, which is just confusing the crap out of you and
right.
making you so disoriented that he can just put whatever he needs to into your mind.
Right.
Unfortunately, he doesn't get much of a chance because John runs off like an idiot.
Yeah.
But we'll see that in a bit. Why does everyone... I know it's a frowned upon thing to be, but why does everyone enunciate bastard so much in Westeros? That's all I could see in this scene. Bastard.
I think it's because... I mean, it's usually for effect, right? Like, anytime someone's...
But it's every time bastard is said. Every time.
I don't know. It's kind of like when someone is yelling at you negative terms, they usually emphasize it. Like, you know, there's no usually like a... What do they call it? Like, there's not a soft, like, motherfucker that you can give someone. Hey,
no?
Motherfucker. I just want to check in with you. See how you're doing. You know, it's like, motherfucker, what the... So it's bastard's the same way. I just feel like he's trying to go... He's trying... This is part of him... trying to get John's peak performance out of him.
Hmm. All right. We move on to Tywin, who is just absolutely roasting one of his fool officers here for accidentally sending a message meant for their troops to a Stark loyalist house.
Whoops.
Yeah, big mistake. And it's not just any message. It's like troop movement type stuff. Littlefinger shows up to take advantage of Renly's death by convincing Tywin essentially to allow him to make a deal with the Tyrells involving Margaery being married mm-hmm. to their family somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And he also mentions that this deal that happened in Renly's camp with Catelyn about trading Jaime for her daughters.
Yeah,
he's got a lot of info there.
The Tyrion... I mean, it shows the extent the Tyrion's freestyling.
Yeah.
Because he's not checking in with his dad or sending ravens, and also...
Well, his dad's not checking in with anybody in King's
right.
Landing, so...
I think. I mean, this is all a continuation of things we learned from last episode, but mm-hmm. I couldn't tell with the way Tywin's eyes sparkled when he found out his son's proposal. Is he impressed? Is he charmed? Is he, you know, like, oh, what did this fucker come up with, you know? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's probably a little skeptical until he hears the full extent.
And I honestly, it's one of those things where you get the best of both worlds because I don't really, this is not a book thing. I don't have a clear idea of exactly what he thinks about this. So I'm just going off his performance. I'd believe that he's secretly impressed. He's secretly rolling his eyes. Not sure.
The one thing he's not impressed with, and I love, most people will let Littlefinger just be Littlefinger. Tywin is having none of it. Like, Littlefinger says this line about opportunity, like crisis being an opportunity, and he's like, oh, you say that as if you're the first person to ever think it.
Right.
He's not going to let Littlefinger
You're ripping off, you know, fucking Confucius and
right.
Sons.
I love it, because, like, Margaery humors him, Catelyn humors him. Like, a lot of people just let him say the things he's going to say. Tywin doesn't.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't let... Really, any like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting because this episode also humanizes him quite a bit too.
Yeah,
when he tells a story about teaching a dyslexic Jaime to read, but yeah, like you just get the idea that this guy would be a fucking nightmare as a boss, lord, command. I mean,
yeah, any position of authority.
Yeah,
and one of the other core tensions in this scene is obviously does Littlefinger recognize Arya?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Does he know what he's seeing here? Clearly, he's like side-eyeing her and going, do I know that person?
Yeah, I feel like he has to, because Arya was brought to court just recently. Mm. My understanding is that he does. Now, why he doesn't, you know, why he doesn't say anything is another question. I don't have a good answer for that either, except for, you know, like he says, chaos is an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Arya running amok in the Lannister lines is chaos personified.
Yeah, it strikes me as very Littlefinger to take in the knowledge and sit back and say, what will I do with this?
This is something of value.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to cash it in right now, so I'll just put it in my back pocket and see if its value matures.
Yep. Then we go back up to the Night's Watch. They find the scouts and they kill all of them except for this woman named Ygritte, who they question. And she tells them that they should probably burn the bodies of the dead. They think it's a ploy by her to get her friends to see them. Once they're done interrogating her, Corin says, "We have to kill her." John volunteers to do it, but he fails. And she runs and he chases and catches her.
I never got this on the first time through, but watching it this, I got the distinct... Because, you know, they're making Corin out to be a pretty bad dude. He's like...
Bad in what way?
Like, he doesn't see... He sees the wildlings as less than human.
Okay.
Yeah. And is willing to visit atrocities upon them. I got this distinct feeling...
Yeah, his comparisons to Ghost are particularly, like...
Yeah. Yeah,
they're wild beasts. You'll never know their ways. That sort of thing.
Exactly. I never understood in the first time I was watching this. Like, well, why does he leave John to kill? Like, this seems very James Bond villain. I actually got the chilling thought that I think they expected John to rape this woman and then kill her.
Oh boy.
Because why else would you be like, all right, well, do what you need to do, but be quick about it. We'll be up the mountain waiting on you. Like, what the fuck? How long does it take to lop someone's head off?
Yeah.
So I think that gives you an idea of, like, what this Corin Halfhand guy is to the wildlings. Like, he is one of the... Yeah, this guy, he's a bad dude. He's like the Robert Duvall, I love the smell of napalm in the morning character from, you know, Apocalypse Now. Like, he hates and dehumanizes the wildlings, and they'd be happy to hate and torturously kill him. And this is the shit. This is why.
Yeah, I mean, that thought hadn't crossed my mind, but I guess we do know John is a sexist because this person would be dead if it was a man. Yes.
Oh, for sure.
Run through with that sword so fast.
Right.
He wouldn't even have blinked.
And he underestimates her several times to his peril in this one episode.
Uh-huh.
But no, I thought that's like we're supposed to understand that, and that you know, this is one of the things that John doesn't fully appreciate about the Night's Watch either.
Yeah. I could see that. My biggest question here is when John swings his sword, does he just miss? Because I can't understand. I can't parse it. He looks surprised. She looks surprised. I don't know what happens here.
I think he meant to... I don't think he missed her. I think that he swung the sword kind of like as a way, like, okay, I'm going to do it. But then he directed it to... Like, I don't know why he needs to fucking ruin the sword. Either kill her or don't.
Yeah, yeah. And why he's so surprised when he sees it. Like,
I feel
like his body betrayed him here.
Yeah, no,
He was set. His mind was set on killing her, but something in him couldn't do it.
He knows what he has to do. All the things that the Halfhand is saying about, you can't let her go because we can't keep her because we don't have the food. We can't let her go because she'll just go back and tell Mance and the whole jig will be up. Mm-hmm. Like, this is one of those casualties of war type of situation, and John can't do it. He's too chivalrous.
I do like the way that the end of this scene is filmed. They sort of disorient me as an audience member because I couldn't actually tell you how John got to where he slid in from at the end.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
it's pretty effective, I thought.
No, it's cool, and it shows that, like, you know, because contra what the Halfhand was saying about the wildlings, like, you know, John's lived in the north, not the north all of his life, but,
yeah,
you know, maybe he slid on a patch of ice or two. Also, so this is the first time we see Rose Leslie as Ygritte. I really like her. She plays this, like, naturally tough, and she's got the, like, really tough lower class accent that's endemic of the wildlings. I really also my first introduction to her as an actress is in Downton Abbey. She was one of the better characters in the initial run of that show. But yeah, like she's really good at playing Ygritte.
Yeah,
the fiery redheaded wildling.
Yeah, there's something magnetic about her as a performer.
Yeah, she just got these, like, you know, you can see why a guy like John would be kind of like, you know, she's attractive, but in kind of that rough spun wildling way. And she's very fierce and she's got the energy, and you can see why she would intrigue him.
Yeah. Okay, we go back to King's Landing, and Cersei is cursing Tyrion as they watch Myrcella float off toward Dorne. Joffrey acts like an ass by making fun of a kid who's crying, and then he walks through the city as the people demand food. It suddenly turns violent as Joffrey's hit in the face with shit, and he tells his men to kill everyone for it. The royals barely escape with their lives. Tyrion calls Joffrey a vicious idiot king, while Sansa's caught by the crowd, and she's about to be raped, but the Hound manages to find and rescue her at the last minute.
Yeah.
It's a great scene.
It is a great scene. This thing with Joffrey and the fact that Sansa's so appalled that she actually takes a direct... speaking of surprising oneself, I feel like she did, too. Like, she calls Joffrey on his bullshit and then immediately is like, oh, God, what did I just do? I better cover it with a lie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just he's... Joffrey doesn't get it. Like, you've got a couple Kingsguard and the Hound and a lot of the royal family here, and you're going to start a civil war
over
getting hit by shit.
Because he's the king, he's invincible, and that's just not true.
Yeah. And you question the wisdom of, like, maybe, like, why did they have to parade through? Like, why didn't they have more security? It seems like that the Lannisters in general are, if anything, underestimating how angry the people are. Mm-hmm. At the fact that they're starting to starve because food is disrupted because of the war, and also that these stories that Stannis has been telling about the illegitimacy, that stuff is people are ready to believe it. You know,
yeah.
We heard last episode the street peddler kind of like talking about this stuff openly, and Tyrion was more amused by it than anything. He didn't recognize the danger of pouring that, allowing that poison to be poured to the people, and not doing anything about it.
Yeah, when they're already under so much stress.
The High Septon got torn literally to pieces.
What did that guy ever do to them? I feel worse for him than anybody else in that scenario, because I don't think he deserved it.
Well, so the books led us into the backstory of him, and they show like the fact that like this guy is dressed very opulently and he's fat.
Sure, fine.
And the books show that he's very also kind of known to be corrupt and venal. So...
Unless you're going to eat him, I don't see what the point is.
I just think that these people are like, he's an easy target. He's this fat, soft, rich, holy man that doesn't live up to his word, and they're going to tear him to pieces and maybe even eat him. He might end up in a crock pot in Flea Bottom somewhere. But that
in
was
show,
fucking metal.
Yeah, it was. And the guy holds his arm up like a Tusken Raider.
Yeah.
Just shouting into the air. Yeah, it's great. But yeah, in the show, they don't really go into that. They're just like, here's this Septon, and they're going to tear him to pieces.
Right. And then the scene where Joffrey to a relative place of safety within the Red Keep.
Oh, man.
And he's going, oh, kill them. And Tyrion's trying to... I guess as reasonable as you can point out the fact that you can't do this, and he's when he slaps him, he says that he's a vicious idiot. He says, I know the realm has had vicious kings and idiot kings. I don't know it's ever been graced with the vicious idiot kings. Like, you can't insult me. Slaps him and said, oh, and now I've struck the king. Did my hand fall from my wrist?
Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic.
Ballsy for Sir Meryn Trant to deny a direct order from Tyrion, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't serve Tyrion. He's a Joffrey diehard.
Yeah, but, you know, like, I'm just surprised he had the balls to do it, because if I was him, I'd be worried that the next time Bronn and him are in the room, Bronn's is going to stab him.
Yeah, I mean, he did threaten him directly.
Right.
And also, we've seen Janos being carted off already, so it's totally possible.
Yeah.
I feel like Tyrion is really pushing his luck, though, with Joffrey. Like, Joffrey is vicious and he is an idiot, so if he wants to have his brother killed, or sorry, his uncle killed, he probably can.
Yeah, I wonder.
Like, if he turns around right now and says, Meryn, kill that guy.
I don't know.
I think Meryn does it.
How smart do you think Meryn Trant is? Because...
Not very.
Because the thing is like, Tywin would fucking clean house if someone killed Tyrion. Because he would see that as an attack upon himself.
His family, which is what is most important
to him.
Well, not
only that, but he wrote a letter that says, this is the hand, treat him as if you know, and if Meryn Trant does that for the Boy King at his peril. I mean, you're right.
It's an order directly from the king. I don't know that you can
refuse
enough. It.
Like, the Hound would know the score. He'd be like, yeah, okay.
Right.
Wait till your grandpa gets here and confirms that order, then I'll do it.
I mean, does Joffrey just go down the line? Does he say, Meryn, kill that guy? Nah, not going to do it. Okay, next guy in line, kill Meryn.
Yeah.
You find somebody who's willing to follow your order unquestioningly, and that's it.
Yeah, and your point being like that Tyrion is ballsy for doing this too, because it would have been real easy for Meryn Trant to stick a Tyrion right there in the streets and then blame the crowd.
Yeah.
Like, and who would have said otherwise? Like, who was there? Mm-hmm. Cersei, Joffrey, the Kingsguard, the Hound? The Hound's not gonna...
No.
I mean, the Hound's got his own ideas of what's right and what's wrong, but he doesn't give a shit about Tyrion.
No.
Bronn's not there, which is kind of surprising mm-hmm. that the head of the king, the Gold Cloaks isn't there. It was a risky situation. It felt that. It felt chaotic. Like, you know, like, holy shit, is Sansa going to get stabbed? Is she going to get raped? And then, you know, fucking the Hound walking in like Darth Vader.
Yeah.
That's another, speaking of metal scene, just disemboweled that. And I thought, like, okay, he's going to disembowel and the guys will leave. He's gonna eat every chicken in the room.
He is.
You might say.
I love the guy who hits him with a rock, and it doesn't even phase the Hound. He hits him in the armor, which is a bad idea. But I think even full onto the skull, he probably would have just shrugged it off.
Right. And surprisingly gentle with the Sansa.
Yeah.
Like, and then when Tyrion thanks him for his service, he says, "I didn't do it for you." Presumably. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did it because he sees something in Sansa that is, I don't know, that he admires, or maybe he just, like, is not the kind of guy who's going to let a crowd tear a young girl apart. Either way, it reveals a little bit of a depth to Sandor that wasn't there before.
Yep. So we go over to Carth, where Dany is very annoyed that she's waiting for the Spice King of Carth. When he finally arrives, he's the guy who initially met her at the front gate. Dany asks for his ships, and he says no, and he points out that it's a really long shot that he'll get his investment repaid, since she has no allies or armies. Dany makes this impassioned plea, which includes how extraordinary she is, citing the way in which her dragons were hatched, and he still refuses to give her the ships.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because he's got this line he walks where he's not outright disrespectful for her, he's just keeps it all, he's all business.
I think the text of this, yes, is not disrespectful, but everything in the subtext is. I mean, from the way he's standing to the way he talks to her.
And the fact that he kept her waiting.
I mean, we're supposed to understand that she's essentially a child here.
Yeah.
And that he might see her as that.
And she has really nothing to offer.
She doesn't. No, I mean, as far as the business transaction, he's absolutely right. He does not see a way in which he'll ever get a return for this. Her ridiculous dragons are like 5 inches tall.
Right.
They're like Funko Pop figures at this point. They're not doing anything. So I think this guy is right on the business proposition. But like everything else about it, this Wallace Shawn wannabe is just shitting all over her.
But it does seem like he escalates in step with her. Like, you know, he did keep
really?
Her waiting.
I mean, he keeps her waiting. He comes down the stairs and begins the conversation, like, high above her in this dominant position. I think the way it's framed, it's all about
the thing is,
demeaning
is
her.
Yes, you're right. But I think when you're in Dany's position, you cannot afford to take to try to go out-haughty this person. And I feel like she does step for step. Like,
okay,
she wants to be treated like the conquering queen when she's not, and that's the point. Like, I don't think it would have made any difference had she, you know, been like, oh, 1,000 pardons. Oh, thank you for, you know, like if she'd said the right things. But I do think that he kind of escalated his dismissive rhetoric in lockstep with her escalating her kind of unhinged demands for fealty.
And I do feel like that's Dany's role at this point, is to be this person who thinks that she's got this super important destiny that she has to fulfill, but she is completely unprepared for it.
Yeah. And a little, you know, a little delusional about, you know, because like she's finding it's a lot easier to impress, you know, essentially desert nomad people who saw a legit miracle than it is these wealthy, comfortable merchants who, you know, calculate with their presumably a Bacchus. Do they have a Bacchus in Westeros?
I assume so, yeah.
Whatever their bean counting method is, that they have to see like a profit. There has to be, you know, a reasonable expectation for return. And there just isn't with her.
No.
She has nothing but a tenuous, outdated claim to the throne.
Mm-hmm.
And three dragons who could do more damage if you loaded them into a slingshot and fired them than on their own.
For sure. But I don't know. I thought it was still a good scene despite the really just unfortunate position Danny is in, and the tone of the whole thing.
So the other thing is, like, this season, you know, we talked about how this season kind of Danny is, a lot of people get annoyed with her. I don't think Emilia Clarke does herself many favors. Like, how much of this is her just not being able to be commanding and impressive? And how much is it she is acting like someone who's having trouble being commanding and impressive? Because, like,
that's a fair question. I read it more as, like, this character is written this way. And I don't put so much of that on Emilia as an actress. I think she's good. She is just written as a character, rightfully, who is young and naive and driven by this goal that she can't possibly attain.
Well, see, I've always said that, like, I think that she does really good playing, she's good at, like, playing bemused, and she's good at playing powerful, and but anytime she has to emote, like, some kind of sadness or desperation or, you know, those kind of deeper, like, more subtle emotions, she struggles. But I found it very hard to even take her serious. Maybe it's because you're right. The situation as written, this guy's above her and she's below, and she's ranting and raving about fire and blood when she has.
And her position is obviously weak.
Yeah.
And obviously.
They dressed her up kind of like.
And she's pretending it's not.
These merchants have dressed her up like some kind of slave girl from Jabba's palace. So
right.
That doesn't help her being taken serious. So, like, I know she's got a lot of things, but I just. And this scene, I thought, like, this is some dodgy work that's being done.
Okay. I don't agree. I didn't feel that way.
All right.
To each their own. I do like, in retrospect, that this scene is really just a stalling tactic, right? This is a way to get her out away from her people and her dragons so that they can come in and steal them, which we'll see later.
Right.
So we go back to Tywin. He approaches Arya to talk about her reading skills, and he asks who her father was. She says he was a stonemason, and Tywin buys it. She's apparently a good liar. Arya asks about his father and steals a parchment from Tywin's table as he waxes not so nostalgic about it. He says his father loved everyone, loved his family, but he was a weak man. He's equating, I guess, love with weakness here. A weak man who nearly destroyed our house and name. It's like father, like son, my ass, you know? Tywin seems to have been directly influenced by the weakness he perceived in his father to become the exact opposite of that and care in his own way about his family, but right. In merely the preservation of the name.
Right. And he wants, like, his son to be educated, and, like, a weaker man who loved his son more might take it easy on her, and Jaime might be illiterate. Would.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, it's like, you know, would Jaime love him more if he was illiterate? Like, is that acceptable? Like, I think it's this scene asks you to hold a bunch of contradictory thoughts about Tywin and kind of see how he came by his, like, prickly kind of love. And I also don't, like, I don't totally agree that he cares nothing except for his family's name. I think he does care about his children, but he, you know, sees his ultimate duty as making sure that they're positioned to have this dynastic ambition that, like, the only way to preserve the Lannisters is to make sure they're running shit.
Well, that's kind of what I mean. Like, he wouldn't give a shit, like, what Jaime's hopes and dreams are.
Mm-hmm.
He's more going to force him to buckle down and do the things that are going to prepare him to perpetuate the family line.
True that.
And the family authority, you know?
Right. Now, do you think that, because you seem to think that Tywin's completely snowed in by Arya, and I'm not saying that he knows that she's Arya Stark, because I don't think that's true, but I do think that he knows there's depth to her, and he is keeping her around, like, his own private Sudoku.
Okay.
Like, he's trying to figure out, like, what's the deal with this northern peasant girl who can read and who has a stone maester father who can read and who died from loyalty. Like, this is an interesting challenge to him.
Okay.
And he can see that. I don't know that he knows the attraction or the fascination of her to him, but he's like, you know, he can see that, and he's kind of fascinated by her, and they're having this interesting little duel, and which makes their scenes really tense, because that. You know, when you're watching this, you're supposed to think, and I think they do this successfully, that at any moment he could, like, whirl around and be like, God damn it, you're Arya Stark. You know? That's the danger, because he's so damn smart and perceptive. But and the fact that we've been told that Tywin is so damn smart and perceptive, when he freely offers the observation that she's a sharp thing, our estimation of Arya rises right with his.
Yeah.
So it's a great scene to build, kind of continue to build both their characters.
Mm-hmm. So Arya reads this parchment that she's stolen, and she's stopped by one of the officers who busts her. Speaking of these officers, like, Tywin might be keeping her around literally to plan his next battle plan because these guys seem to be fools.
Did you know the guy who grabbed her is the same illiterate guy from,
yeah,
okay, that
from the previous scene.
Amory Lorch is his name.
Yeah.
Which I didn't realize when I was watching this the first time, I didn't realize it was the same guy because I wasn't quite as steeped in Game of Thrones lore. But like that's the.
Oh, okay.
And the other thing
is... I'm not
is,
either. I just recognize his face.
I also thought, like, if I was observing this, I'm like, it's kind of ballsy for this guy who can't read the message to question Tywin's personal page.
Like, yeah, he's just been dressed
down.
He's
like, well, why would you take this to the armory? It's like, I don't... It's your fucking lord's orders. You can't read them. It's in his... You probably recognize his handwriting. I'm his page. What the... Like, in another universe, he comes into Tywin and just gets, like... Tywin's like, you know what? Fuck you. You already pissed me off this morning. I'm throwing you off this four-story window. You're too goddamn stupid to live.
I don't care if you are my cousin.
Right. He's just a lorch. He's
Oh yeah, he's not even a Lannister. He's
yeah,
done.
Tywin torch a lorch without even thinking about it.
So she runs to Jaqen and she names this officer and says it has to happen right now, which Jaqen's like, oh, fine,
yeah,
fine. I was going to get lunch, but whatever.
The performance where he's like, you know, because he starts his unctuous kind of like, oh, a girl has named another name. Oh, a man has to wait to the time. Oh, fuck. This just
she's like,
like,
I don't have time for this shit, Jaqen.
Right. And he's like, he's kind of annoyed, but also, you know, there's another guy who we've been taught to think of as fucking impressive, and he is suffering Arya. And you're like, again, you keep on thinking that Arya is awesome, more and more awesome because she has this effect on these people around her.
Mm-hmm.
Also, shit, holy shit, what can Jaqen not do?
Yeah, I guess he knew where this guy was headed, but the guy had a big head start on him.
Oh, yeah.
And Jaqen ends up putting a
right
poison arrow in his
neck. Right as opening the door is what you're supposed to realize. Because he's like, I looked like he's about to say, Adidas falls forward dead
yeah,
to that dart
great.
In his neck. It's fucking awesome.
So good. You know, I couldn't help but thinking, instead of naming this Amory Lorch guy, you could just solve the whole problem by naming Tywin Lannister. my question is, would she at this point? Like, does she, to go back to what Duck Sauce says earlier about never meeting a woman who wasn't influenced at least a little bit by flattery, is she maybe drawn into the world of Tywin a little
That's
bit
a
too
good
much
question.
Here by his compliments?
Because
sad stories.
You're right. The fact that she hasn't tried to name Tywin yet is a little suck. Because last week we covered it by saying, well, she didn't know that Jaqen could just be blowing her shit.
Yeah.
Now she knows he's legit. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to give Arya a lot of credit, this is not on, I don't think necessarily on the screen, but she might be smart enough to perceive if I kill Tywin, the war will still go on and northern men will still die.
But if you don't, the same is true.
But no, if I can subvert and like be like this inside spy, he has no idea.
Yeah.
Then maybe I can be, you know, I can actually be a force multiplier.
Yeah.
You know, because like, let's say she kills Tywin and then Tywin's brother. I've forgotten his name.
But they're all dumbasses. They made it a point that Tywin's the only guy here who really has his head on his shoulders.
I mean, yeah, the few people that we've seen like open their mouth and say things have been, you know, poo-pooed by Tywin for sure. I don't know that we're supposed to understand his entire war council.
Yeah.
Is fucking, you know,
I'm just
fucking
working
idiots.
With the examples I have.
Right. Like Kevin Lannister is his brother.
Yeah.
You know, because if every last Lannister except for himself and Tyrion are fucking idiots, that's, I don't know, it says something about his character. I'm not sure I'm ready to co-sign.
Yeah.
Like that means he surrounded himself with idiots and he's given he's weak to nepotism.
which makes him a certain kind of idiot.
Yeah. So, like, okay. I'm trying to find a way, but you're right. That's a great question. Why isn't she naming Tywin right now?
And if I'm being a little generous, I could say it's heat of the moment. She knows she has to do something, and she just does the first thing that comes to her mind.
It's like a genie's wish, you know? You got three of them. Do you want to, you know, what happens if you name Tywin? Well, you're right. You only have... I don't have very many defenses about why she wouldn't name Tywin right
now. No, I mean, I like yours. If she can be a spy, she might be more useful. Because the next commander of this army is not going to have her as their cupbearer.
Probably not.
So she's in a unique position. We go to Rob walking through the camp, spreading goodwill. Really congratulating his men, I think, on the battle that they just won.
And this is the classic, oh, this is a good commander scene. You see it in, you know, you see it in stuff like Spartacus. You see it in, like, fucking Gladiator. You see it, like, in the guys going around clapping his men. He fucking knows the armor bender for Sir What's-His-Fuck. Like,
right.
He knows him by first name basis. And that's like, oh, this is this is not just a... strategic commander, but he also has inspired this intense loyalty in his men, and this is why.
Speaking of people he knows on a first name basis, he spots Talisa, whom he calls a lady because it's obvious to him that she's of noble birth. They flirt for a while, and then Rob asks her to join him for something, but his mom shows up and puts the kibosh on it. He introduces her to Talisa, but she runs away almost immediately. And Catelyn reminds Rob, look, you're promised to another, and you cannot pursue Talisa. And he knows. I know, Mom.
I know, Mom. Jeez. I wasn't
thinking
that. We
were just talking.
We're just friends.
Then Roos comes in, and he delivers some news from Winterfell.
Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, as far as flirting scenes go between nobles, this is pretty good. I enjoyed it. There's definitely charisma between these two. Mm-hmm. So it shows. I don't have a whole lot more on that scene.
Well, so the one thing I want to talk about, and I don't know, we might have to mark this because this might be inappropriate, but there was a lot of real-time speculation back in season two about there's this very popular theory about the fact that Talisa could be a spy. And I remember this scene as one of the first pieces of evidence because she's writing this letter. And Rob kind of confronts her about it, and she tells this lie about, like, oh, it's you know, I'm detailing King Rob's movements to the Lannisters, mm-hmm. which is like, ha ha, unless she's killing him with the truth, you know?
Yeah.
Like, she's telling him...
Covering one lie with another.
Right. And the fact that, like, she's this foreign woman that no one's ever heard of, and her name, and she's in Westeros doing... what, Doctors Without Borders kind of shit? And
we come right off the back of a scene where Arya is a spy stealing letters about troop movements.
There's this idea that she might have like this, and she's also, as Kat points out, you know, if Rob gets Twitter pated by it, it's a political liability as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying if that's right or wrong. I just want to say that this was very real. Lots of time spent and analyzing her, you know, movements throughout these episodes.
I think that's fair. There's a lot of suspicious activity here. Okay, so we go to John deciding that they're going to stop, him and Ygritte are going to stop in the middle of nowhere with no shelter and no fire. And he very, very loosely ties up Ygritte for the night and gets down and spoons her. And she's grinding on him, which is really annoying to him. But she's having
that ass up.
Pretty good time with it, I'd say. just annoying the crap out of John, which I enjoyed.
Or
yeah, making... I mean, poking at him, just like
I think he's poking at her.
He probably is at that point, but yeah, I don't know. I really liked it.
He's trying so hard to find a middle path between what he thinks is his duty and.
I think the tone...
Being close to her booty.
The tone is a little weird here because I guess at this point she's just figured out, look, John's not going to kill me, period. I can do anything I want. I can fuck with him to no end, and he is not going to bring that sword down on my neck.
Also, I think this is story. This is a little bit of storytelling established the wildlings and their culture. Like, they're just not as dour, duty-bound. Yeah. Like, you're right. She no longer fears him, and now she's having fun with him.
Yeah.
And I'd also think, you know, if you take her at her word, she's also trying to turn him. She thinks that, like, here's this brave but stupid boy who clearly, you know, stayed his hand because I'm a pretty girl.
Yep.
And I'm going to try to play this hand as well as I can.
Yeah. I think she plays it pretty well. We go over to the news from Winterfell and Rob's camp, and it's all bad. Rob gets pissed about Theon taking Winterfell and he wants to take it back. So Roose volunteers to do it, and Rob says, keep my brother safe, that's the top priority, and also bring Theon back alive so I can look him in the face and ask him why the hell he did it and then cut his head off. A pretty utilitarian scene here, although I liked it. Rob is appropriately angry.
Yeah, like he's like, why would he do this? And Roose is like, well, the Greyjoys are treasonous whores.
Yeah, that's just fact.
QED. And also Kat comes rushing in with, I told you. Like, come on. Like, that's influencing people 101 when they know that they done been told. And it's very hard to resist. But it destroys the power of the lesson you just taught by just, you know, I told you, stupid son of a bitch.
Yeah, yeah, it makes them more resentful than they should be.
Also, when Roose is referring to his child here, this is the softest bastard I think you've ever heard.
Yeah,
this wasn't a spat. It's just like, yeah, hey my bastard at the Dreadfort.
Yeah, he called the motherfucker too. He said, my motherfucking bastard.
Motherfucking, yeah, he just, yeah.
Back at the Dreadfort, yeah. Would do this for us.
Yeah,
as
soft as silk with the swears on this guy.
All right, so we go over to Winterfell, and Asha is making another play for her survival by offering to fuck Theon. It comes at a price, though. She wants her freedom. He agrees. That's it. That's the whole scene. She takes her clothes off. He's eating apples. They bang, done.
Mm-hmm. He could eat an apple for hours. he's gonna Nick Cager.
Castor Theon. All right, Shay is tending to Sansa's wounds while she ponders how people could hate a noble girl who hates the king just like they do. And Shay says, hey, you don't get any of it, but also don't trust anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... Shay, I had a reader or a listener rather reach out and like kind of query about why I hate Shay so much. Mm-hmm. And like, I think half of it's the character and half of it is the actor. But the thing I kind of narrowed in on is that, you know, Shay is many things. Like sometimes she has scenes like this where it seems like there is some genuine like empathy and fellow feeling towards people.
Mm-hmm.
And then she has scenes where she's a spoiled brat, and then she has a scene where she's conniving, manipulating. But, like,
yeah.
I always feel like she plays it exactly how the script says it. Like, I feel like a notch better actor would have some kind of work with the writers and directors to have an idea of what her character is really thinking and what she is mm-hmm. really like. And that would come across in all her portrayals. But she's not. She's just always, she's either conniving or spoiled or caring or empathetic, but there's no like backbone or through line for that character, yeah. Which I think, you know, most of the time I'd probably say it's probably poor direction, except for poor direction is not exactly one of the things people say about Game of Thrones.
Sure.
You know, it's like, it's, you know, a pretty good show, decent production values. Boy, they can't direct themselves out of a burlap sack.
No, not at all. I think this scene is interesting to... It puts a little light on Shay when it comes to her and Tyrion's relationship as well.
Right.
And the development there. Because when she says don't trust anyone, I fully think at this point she includes Tyrion in that. She may be starting to doubt that Tyrion actually wants her there for the reasons that he said he did in the first place. I think that there's... That is developing in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, and I do think this is one of her better scenes. I just think that, like, whatever And it was written as this kind of character moment, but I don't feel like that character moment then goes back and reinforms what she does with her character going forward.
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, we go back over to Theon. He has fallen asleep with Asha next to him, and I thought she was just going to kill him. But instead, she gets up and tries to run off. She's stopped by a guard, whom she kills, and then she escapes with Hodor, Bran, Rickon, and the dogs.
What's these fucking great... These Iron Islanders, pretty fucking stupid.
Yeah, how would you ever feel comfortable sleeping in that room?
Right?
With a wildling who
that
would kill you if
too,
she could.
Where, like, they're going to be able to... Yeah. I'm staggered by how much these guys think with their dicks and... You know, quickly.
And I mean, okay, so he wants to think with his dick, fine, but then to just fall asleep there?
Well, but then the dude, like, she comes creeping out of his quarters and he's like,
and
oh,
he's
yes,
immediately
my
taken in.
My lord said me to keep all you men warm, and he's like, yeah, like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, you're not even, you're fucking on guard. I don't know.
It's tough in Game of Thrones because I always view these people as being, like, late 20s, but I know they're supposed to be, like, fresh kids, like,
yeah,
green.
Yeah, you're
just,
right.
Thinking with their libido
and they're
all
not
the time.
Educated. They're very provincial. Yeah. Like this kid probably had never been off to Iron Island before.
It's always hard for me to get in that mindset with
you're
them,
right.
Though.
You're right. Like any average person on the street, like you, like the countryest bumpkin is 10 times as urbane and worldly as a person from, you know, Village A from Game of Thrones.
Right. So I don't know. We go back over to Dany, who is complaining about not being able to get what she wants, to Duck Sauce as they walk through the city back to her place she's staying. I don't know. They gave her some kind of quarters.
I think this is Zaro's own mansion.
Is it? Okay.
That's where
Duck Sauce tells her that he was a pitiful poor boy once and that he did some really foul things in the past to get to where he is. And she returns to find her people are murdered and her dragons are missing. And then we see the dragons are being taken to some mysterious tower.
But it seems, it also seems like to me that they want us to think that it's the warlocks that have taken her.
Do they?
I think so.
Why do you say that?
Because I felt like that's what the garb of the person carrying the dragons were.
Mm, okay.
But also, it happened while she was meeting with the Spice King.
Yeah. Which to me says that's a distraction from the Spice King.
Right.
To get a hold of the dragons.
Right. But then what I'm saying is I feel like there's like three main suspects here because there's also Zaro himself who just gave this speech about like a kind of a Lando Calrissian that reminded me a lot of Lando's speech of, I used to have a lot of problems here at Cloud City, but it's smooth sailing because of a deal I recently made. And then there's Darth Vader and shit goes bad. And, you know, as he's saying, I'm like, yeah, I used to have to do terrible things to get to the things I want in the world. Oh, my God, where's my dragons? And so yeah. I feel like there's like this mystery that you're the three prime suspects are the Spice King, the Warlocks, and Zaro himself. Mm-hmm. And we shall see.
Or Jorah. Where's Jorah in all this, huh?
Damn straight.
Haven't seen him for a while.
Right.
Getting to ship my ass.
Yeah, Danny's getting a little too independent. You know, a little too not dependent on his council, so he set her back a couple paces. Fucking nice guy, Jorah.
We get a Where Are My Dragons?
Yeah, I had to stop
this.
Doing that at the top of the show because people rightfully pointed out it's a fucking spoiler for this episode. But
her dragons are gone.
We got with a bullet the Where Are My Dragons. This is the canonical Where Are My Dragons. Perhaps the only Where Are My Dragons.
Perhaps. We'll have to see. She shouts, Where Are They? As well. Does that count as two?
Yeah.
Or are we going specifically with Where Are My Dragons?
No. That pronoun means dragons.
She's referring to dragons, yeah.
Yeah, you don't need a Rosetta Stone to translate that. That's the two. Boom. Two. Where are brackets my dragons?
Yep.
It's interesting because what we see as evidence is it looks like a lot of Zaro's household guard is killed. Because that's the thing. Like, there was definitely Dothraki. You know, there's Eerie. There is one of her blood right. Well, no, not her blood right. But you could saw some of the Dothraki guards. But then there's also guards dressed up like they're from Karth. So I feel like that's evidence against. Like, why would Zaro break into his? But then again, if he was the one that stole the dragons, he would have to do that because if like he suffered zero repercussions, in the attack, then he would be prime suspect, right?
I would think so. Yeah. So. Who knows? I imagine we'll find out pretty soon.
Where are her dragons?
They're going to a tower.
They're in a cage.
In a box.
They're being carried. Yeah.
They're in a medieval backpack, I guess.
It's not that hard, Danny. They're just like, if you just patiently watch the next scene, you'd find that's like, Jesus Christ. So Danny's the kind of person halfway through the movie be like, why are they doing this? That's the whole fucking point. Shut up and watch.
Yep, that's the end of the episode. Do we have some feedback this week?
We do, but we do not have any non-spoilery feedback to
None.
Make the cut.
Okay.
Nope. So
well, that's it, I guess.
First time that we don't have any non-spoiler feedback, but we do have a lot of spoiler feedback in the spoiler section, which we'll be getting to momentarily. If you'd like to send feedback, either non-spoilery or general, you can do that through GameOfThrones@baldmove.com, or you can also send it to the same place to be considered for a spoiler section. We also have forums, forums.baldmove.com, where you can take there to discuss the show, as well as all the social media, if you want to follow along with what we're doing, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, that kind of thing. That's it. I think we're ready for spoiler section.
Okay. Well, people who are interested in spoilers, join us in just a second. People who are not, we'll see you next week for 207. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa. Starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis, Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
Hey, if you've enjoyed our coverage of Season 2 of Game of Thrones, the only thing that makes it possible is that we're doing this full-time. If we weren't, we never would have gone back and done this rewatch. So if you would like to contribute to... keeping our lights on here at the Bald Move Studio, you can do so at club.baldmove.com. It's an easy way to support us, and you get a bunch of free of bonus extra features. There's bonus audio content. There's ad-free feeds. There's VIP access to the forums. We do those video game playthroughs and spoiler-filled first-run bald movies. And there's a lot of hot movies coming up. There's the Thor 3. Star Wars is around the corner. There's going to be a lot of popular ones coming out. Get ahead of the game. Join the club. Help us keep producing all the content that we do at club.baldmove.com.
Okay, let's get to those spoilers.
Okay. Jasmine says, I started out watching season 2 with you guys, but of course I couldn't limit myself to one episode a week, so now I'm in season 4. Littlefinger has just pushed Liza Aaron through the moon door, and Sans very convincingly lied to the other Lords of the Vale and backed up his story of her committing suicide. Mm-hmm. My question is, why didn't Sansa just tell the truth right then and there instead of getting rid of Littlefinger and securing her safety? He would have been put to death. She would have been able to stay in the relative safety of the Vale until she could marry Robin and then potentially rule over it once she manipulated him enough. I didn't put much thought at it at the time, but after seeing everything she went through with Littlefinger and the whole plot her and Arya cooked up this most recent season to kill him, it makes a lot less sense to me. She saw a snake like he was, both in engineering her escape and what he said to Liza before killing her. He's obviously not to be trusted. I can't remember if there's any specific POV chapters from her in the book explaining her reasoning, so I'm hoping you can help me with this.
I mean, my guess is he had just saved her life, essentially, and that was repayment.
There's that, but, like, this is the season where Sansa started to stop being a scared little girl and started thinking about the future in terms of, like, more than just, I hope I make it through tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key point. Like, Sansa could have betrayed Littlefinger. She's now under the protection of Lords of the Vale, and she's just become another chip to be played, you know, because what if the Lords of the Vale want to get in good with King's Landing in the future? They trade her Sansa, and then she's back in hot water. I think part of it is like what you said. She feels a little bit of gratefulness to the Littlefinger. Littlefinger at this point is also kind of betrayed a weakness for her. And mm-hmm. I think that she starts thinking about how she can play the game, because that's ultimately the only way she can guarantee her safety is she keeps her destiny in her own hands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's progressed enough at this point in the story, Jasmine, that I don't think that she sees being guarded by men who are supposedly knights is any kind of real sure permanent safety.
Yeah.
Whereas she does have a lever where she can manipulate Peter. Yeah. If anybody else has any thoughts on that, but that's how I've always interpreted it. David H., my question is about one of John or Gior Mormont's scenes earlier this season. After John watches a White Walker take one of Craster's baby and reports it back to the Lord Commander, Mormont acknowledges that he, in fact, knew Craster had been sacrificing babies to the White Walkers, the crueler gods that Craster serves. This suggests Mormont was aware of the existence of White Walkers well before they appeared in the show in season one. Why then is he never told anyone about this threat? In the season one opener, Ned beheads the Night's Watchman for desertion and hand waves his comments about seeing the White Walkers as crazy talk. If Mormont is in command of a group whose origin is literally rooted in combating the White Walkers, why keep Craster's sacrifices to himself? Do you have any ideas here, Jim?
Is that implied?
That was my question.
Does John know exactly what he's seen? I can't remember if he specifically says he was giving them to the White Walkers.
I mean, I think that's the implication, but when Mormont talks about these crueler gods, I think he's talking about just in terms of, like, child sacrifice, not necessarily, yeah. Oh, I knew he was sacrificing them to the others all along.
Right.
It's more like, you know, things are harder up here, and they still, like, you know, they follow the old ways and the ways that we don't, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's conclusive to say that he knew about the White Walkers, all of them. But, I mean, intellectually, I think that all the Night's Watch have to accept, I think, the mystical nature of their duties. Like, I think that the Night's Watchmen probably believe in the others and their mission. It's just that they've been dormant for so long.
Sure.
Their primary threat is the wildlings raiding the north, then, you know, the Grumpkins and Snarks. But again, that's an opinion. I don't know. Because otherwise, you're right. If he had proof that there's White Walkers this whole time, why hasn't he been sounding the alarm?
Mm-hmm.
Connor F., in the last episode during feedback, you were talking about the question of whether or not Ned has been avenged for his death. And you got to talking about all the fucks who deserved the vengeance. slash murder that came their way. I also want to point out that motherfucking Janos Slynt gets the chopping block by, wait for it, Aegon Targaryen at the wall. And it was he who sold Eddard Stark out to Cersei back in season one, only to have his blood end his life for his insolence. Okay, we talked about this fucking Aegon shit.
It's very confusing.
I don't want this to become a recurring thing in the feedback.
Jon Snow.
It's Jon Snow. At best, it's Jon, quote-unquote, Aegon Targaryen Snow. Let's get that straight. Fair point. But that's the thing. Like, is he the most responsible for Ned's death?
It's tough to say. Because
he's just a pawn of Littlefinger.
Yeah.
And the guy who chopped off his head is, you know, ill in pain. But
Joffrey ordered it. The most responsible?
Yeah, probably who the most responsible is Littlefinger.
Okay,
because like, he's the one that's set all this stuff in motion, and you're right. We left him off the list of people who got theirs, but good. Robert R. I believe Game of Thrones arrived at the perfect time, culturally. I couldn't imagine it being made before the first episode premiered. If it was made in the 70s or 80s, it'd be a terrible one-time movie that wouldn't make any sense and feel rushed.
Oh my
If it was
God.
Made in the 90s or aughts, it would have been a really corny, low-budget, and unenthused adaptation. I'm thinking it'd be similar to The Black Knight with Martin Lawrence or Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger. But I'm curious what you guys think. Could you imagine Game of Thrones made any earlier than its premiere?
Hey, Knight's Tale is great. I don't want to hear any guff about Knight's Tale.
I'll throw in First Knight with Richard Gere and Sean Connery.
Okay.
That was another terrible swords and sorcerers.
Oh, I mean, there are so many. Like, the 80s is so full of these fucking things.
Or was that 70s?
Death Stalker and just, like, all these crappy sword and sandal.
Crawl.
Right, Conan, like all
of
those.
Conan is kind of good.
Yeah,
but
if it was Game of Thrones, it would be kind of shitty.
true that. Because, like, I say it's kind of good because it was written by Oliver Stone and competently directed, and it also, you know, one of Arnold's breakout roles. But have you seen James Earl Jones in a dress lately?
And his
70s disco wig?
Yeah.
It's not great.
No, it's not.
It is not great. So, yeah. Yeah.
I think he's right. I think you cannot you could not have made this series any earlier than it was made. Even like late 2000s.
I feel like it could have been made immediately after Lord of the Rings, because that's kind of first of all, it got fantasy back to like science fiction levels where people would spend a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
And two, the effects technology started to get to the point where you could tell these crazy, fantastic stories on a reasonable budget.
For sure, but I don't think television as a medium was ready for it yet. I think it needed a lot of shows to come before it to get people back into the idea of serious television. Because for me, I don't know how most people feel about this, but all through the 2000s, television was sort of a joke, with the exception of very few shows like Lost or Battlestar or
Sopranos. And even those, all those examples have pretty big flaws. Like, even Sopranos, I haven't seen enough of it to say that, but I've heard many, many people say that when you rewatch Sopranos, you're actually kind of shocked at how many throwaway episodes and filler episodes there are.
Yeah. And I think you needed those precursors to get people ready for the idea of some kind of niche, themed drama.
Yeah, like this
even
long,
Lost,
sprawling narrative. Yeah.
That was sold as like a drama. Like, they had to hide this sci-fi story in a drama.
Yeah.
To get it even past the people who would greenlight it.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I was thinking that from like technical feasibility, but you're right. Like, training an audience to enjoy this type of narrative was one of the innovations of the golden age of television.
Yeah.
Because before it was prized at like, well, a person should just be able to go in middle of season three and instantly understand the characters and the situations. That was the whole idea of
these procedurals. And a season's got to be 24 episodes.
Right, because, you know, you got to be able to do reruns and sweeps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the Golden Age kind of dumped all that shit and said, no, like, if you try to come in the middle of season three, you're going to be fucking lost. Yep. Go catch up on Netflix or HBO Go. And
can you imagine a 24-episode season of Game of Thrones?
You know, the other thing about we don't appreciate about the Golden Age is the roles that these digital delivery systems played in it. Yeah. Because it's an open question whether that shit would have worked without on-demand services. Because, like, who starts watching Breaking Bad in the middle of season three if the only way to catch up is to, like, fucking rent DVDs at Blockbuster?
Yeah, or spend $30-$40 for a DVD set of
season
one.
Exactly. Being able to, like, oh, this is on HBO Go, or oh, this is on Netflix. That's like,
right,
really,
I've already got this service. It just showed up. I might as well check it out. I've heard good things.
That never used to, the shows that always have the biggest audiences, and they trail until they were canceled. Yeah. Because the cost of getting into it at any midpoint was so high. Now in the Golden Age, we see where, you know, Breaking Bad does a million, then 2 million, then 3 million, then 6 million, then 10. And Game of Thrones does the same thing. And the only reason that's able to happen is because it's so easy for people to binge and catch up.
Yeah.
So you're right. Technologically and budgetary, they could have done it, you know, anytime after Return of the King. Mm-hmm. Culturally and, you know, like the workflow of a general audience, yeah, I think you got a strong point there, Jim.
And so does the emailer.
Alexander F., how old is Bran supposed to be at the end of season 7?
8.
In general, how old are any of these characters?
That's a really good question. I have a really hard time keeping it straight. How old are they in the books?
I'm not a book reader, but I've listened enough of your blather, you say, to know about these book characters being very, very young. For example, Danny.
I think you just called Gizmo Duck in.
What was his thing?
Blathering Blatherskite.
There you go. Okay. So the consensus seems to be about 2.5 to 3.5 years have elapsed from A Game of Thrones to the very end of Dance with Dragons, which is in the 5 going on 6 season. So
okay,
maybe another 6 months on top of that. But the weird thing is, in fact, if you want to know the comprehensive answer of how much time has passed, Google search most precise A Song of Ice and Fire timeline, because it will direct you to a Google Doc that has every canonical statement that's tied to a date in the books, and they lay them out in sequential, and so you can see like all the different events and roughly what year and month they are. And that's helpful. That's why you go 2.5 to 3.5, because the show's gone a little bit further. But the problem is, George, when he wrote A Game of Thrones, planned this to be a trilogy that in the middle there'd be a 5-year skip ahead. Mm-hmm. So he started out with, Bran starts off the series as 8, and Arya's 9, and Sansa's 11, and like Jon and Robb are 15. So his idea was, you know, when we jumped ahead and told the rest of the story, that these would all be, you know, grown adults or, you know, more like seasoned. And that did, he started writing Feast and Dance, realized he couldn't really connect those characters together. Like, it would be preposterous to just like, flash forward and now Arya is a faceless man, and flash forward and now Dany went from being this, you know, jumped up slave girl who had 3 miraculous dragons to a queen ruling her own right. And John, maybe most jarring of all, went from this kind of like whiny brat who on a lark went and joined the wildlings to
the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. Yeah.
And yeah. So he's like, ah, oh, shit. So I have to start filling this out, which made the time jump impossible. So you still have, you know, John is now, you know, 16 or 17, and Danny is in 16, and Bran is like 10. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's weird things like, I feel like that Bran and Mira are supposed to have a relationship, like a teenage relationship, but Bran is only 10 years old in the book, so it doesn't really work. It's like an Anakin Padme thing in the first Star Wars. So,
sure.
I mean, the right answer is 2.5 to 3 years, but I think that with both the books and the show, you're supposed to understand that, number one, in like medieval times, 13 and 14 year olds are starting to, they'd be looking to get married and settle down. Mm-hmm. So like everyone's kind of more mature than you think. And also you're supposed to have in the back of your mind that Martin originally intended to have this 5-year jump. So everyone's slightly older than you think they are.
Yeah.
But it's kind of...
Which kind of works out in the show because they are 5 or 6 years older than they were at the beginning.
Right. Even though in universe, not that much time has elapsed. And there's also a lot of weird, Sam and Gilly's baby.
Uh-huh.
It's still a baby for 5 seasons, even though, you know, Isaac Hempstead Wright went from being 10 years old to 27.
Sure.
So it's a little jarring, but that's the best answer I can give you. Stephanie has some questions about the Faceless Men. Jaqen tells Arya that the many-faced gods demand assassination of specific people, and he punishes Arya when she fails to follow through. He admonishes her by saying a servant doesn't get to choose who dies. But then who really does get to choose? Is there some sort of screening process, or are they just assassins for hire for anyone and everyone who can pay their fee? Is there a deeper meaning to who is supposed to die? If regular people are giving the Faceless Men their assignments, how does the many-faced gods factor into all this? Are they really working for their god, or just to turn a profit? Are there ever situations in which a faceless man are allowed to choose a target?
So this is super interesting because, like, when I was doing the research for the podcast that we did, where we talked about the religions of Westeros, the many-faced god worshippers, the faceless men were one of those factions,
right?
And it was very dubious to claim that the gods were the ones choosing the deaths when the people who were commissioning these assassinations were coming directly to the Faceless Men, and the Faceless Men were deciding what they would charge, essentially. Like, what is this death worth?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if they have some kind of ritual communion with what they would call the many-faced god in order to determine that. I don't know what their rituals around that are, but it seems that they just take a look at the situation and say, this is what we're going to charge. This... They will sometimes even deny a request to assassinate someone. So I think they're really the ones choosing here.
Well, I mean, I think the Faceless Men would say that in as much as God is in control of all things and all men die, that a person coming with a contract is a physical manifestation of the will of the many-faced gods.
Sure. Sure, but how do they decide how much to charge? How do they decide when they deny a request?
Well, they do have, you mentioned a ritual. Like, for what I can tell, once a month, the Faceless Men meet at the House of Black and White, mm-hmm. and they consider all their open contracts, and then they match up the contracts with the assassins that they have available. Okay. And they set the price. It's like, I don't think they're like, oh, this is a king wanting a princess die, so let's charge 50 million gold dragons. It's more like we will consider anything. It's like a sliding scale, and the price is always extremely dear. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a poor miller.
But that's still an evaluation that they're making.
Yeah, but it's not based on the worthiness of the request. It's based on the person's means.
Sure. Sometimes they will flat out deny it, though.
Did you see that in research? Because I didn't.
That's what I read in the wiki, but I don't know how accurate that is. I haven't read the books or anything.
Okay, because I was just reading in the World of Ice and Fire, because I just assumed they wouldn't ever deny a contract. They would probably, you know, people. A lot of people get the price and then get cold feet.
Well, here's, I don't know, the other thing that they do clearly that we see Jaqen do in this season is they will claim that the faceless god had the right to those deaths and mm-hmm. that Arya took them, and now somehow she gets to name mm-hmm. the people who will be their replacements.
Right.
I don't know how that works either.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the mechanics by which they're operating, but I don't understand how they justify it within their religion.
Well, it's because I think it's more like, one of their other core principles is the assassin himself cannot choose the target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the assassin cannot know their target. Like, an assassin can turn it down and is like, oh, I actually went to school with that guy, so.
Okay.
You know, because they're very against personal connections. There have to be no one. Well, if that's a personal relationship, then that could violate their thing. So I think it's more like Jaqen's like, the red god needs, the many-faced god needs his kills. My scriptural restrictions say I can't just kill 3 dudes for the hell of it. So I need you. I have this debt. You could be like my, you know, you can, as not a faceless man, be the person that hands out my contracts and I fulfill them. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, a little spiritual loophole. But no, I do think that the mini face the faceless men see the contract system as, because, you know, your god's either got power or he doesn't.
Sure.
It should be trivial for him to navigate who comes to you and guide you, you know, through this this meeting process and vetting process to come up with the right answer. You know, just like people, shit, I just talked to a woman that said that she drove through an intersection in the winter and she couldn't stop and she went through this busy intersection. She has closed her eyes and said a prayer and she woke up and she's on the ditch on the other side, miraculously safe. Was God's hand in that? Like,
I think if God can guide your car,
right,
then he really doesn't need assassins.
Sure,
he
sure.
Could probably do the killing himself.
But then, see, I mean, that's like of all religions, there's answers to that. Like, yes, God can do everything himself, but he's giving you the opportunity to, you know, to try out for the God Squad, right? Like that gives your life meaning. And if you're as nihilistic a fuck as the average faceless man, that's probably pretty nice. To think that you're giving God a solid. You know, I don't know. I wonder what they, because the other thing is like, the other question I have now is like, what is their concept of an afterlife? Are they going to have a better place because they serve the many-face God? Or is this, since nothing means anything, helping people to do grave early is the best thing you can do?
Yeah, I think it's a lot like the Lord of Light situation where he views, the followers of Lord of Light view Westeros, view Planetos, I guess, or life as a hell that right. they are freeing people from by burning them and sending them to the other place, which is death.
Even if the other place is in nothingness, it's still a respite from hell. So
right.
Just to know, as another follow-up on the old faceless men here, after the talking up of Jaqen that you guys did last episode, I feel like it's necessary to point out that his kills are by no means guaranteed. No faceless men's are guaranteed.
Not
for
as
that
far
matter.
As I've seen.
Yeah. If they were to fail, presumably die under failure, the many faced gods still get their death. When the waif sets out to kill Arya and Braavos with Jaqen's approval, she's the one claimed by death. I feel like the promise that is made when the name is given is just that, a promise. As an additional note, this could explain why Jaqen lets Arya go peacefully from the House of Black and White. The waif was dead, the many faced god received their due, and there is no reason to pursue the matter further. It's also why I think that in the show at least we have seen the last of Jaqen H'ghar and the Faceless Men.
Okay. That's fairly compelling.
Yeah, it's fairly compelling, but again, the Faceless Men are mysterious enough that we really don't understand all that makes them tick.
That's true.
But yeah, I never really thought of it that way, that like, well, the Many-Faced God got his kill, and if the waif wasn't able to kill Arya, then the Many-Faced God must not have wanted it to happen yet.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's just like Melisandre keeps saying when people are amazed that they're still alive, well, the Red God must still want you alive. And if you're dead, then the Red God is done with you. It's tidy. Tidy how that belief system works.
Pretty convenient.
Mary P. from Minnesota. What happened to the Shadow Baby after it killed Renly? Did it just evaporate?
Yeah.
Can Melisandre make another one?
Yeah.
I know there isn't much entertainment value for a shadow to kill all the kings, so maybe it's just a convenient one and done. But is there more explanation in the books on how this magic system works? No.
No?
No.
Okay.
I mean, you maybe, because you're right. Like, this, like, Stannis could just, like, okay, well, I can do this more. Now, the books have a couple systems that every time that Melisandre uses up a bit of Stannis to do this magic, he gets frailer and weaker looking. Like, you know, he was noticeably aged after this Shadow Baby, and then she uses, you know, these leech-filled king's blood things to, like murder the other kings, essentially, in this ritual. And she gets to a point where she can't really, doesn't feel like she can take from Stannis anymore because it's gonna diminish him. And I think that's the, she needs royal blood and royal seed to make this work. And it's not like, you know, hey, he busts a nut inside Melisandre and he's good to go in 16 hours or whatever. It's more like that's something spiritually done to him that can't be, like, a part of his soul is gone.
I feel like she could have maybe used Gendry for that a little bit more.
Yeah, he could have. He seemed like he was no worse for the wear.
Yeah, he's a strapping young lad. He could handle a couple of Shadow Babies at least.
If they had perfected Viagra, in Westeros. Maybe the War of the Five Kings would have been done in the course of an evening's work.
I think you just put a leech on the tip and just draw the blood all to the surface.
Just the tip?
Yeah, just the tip.
Okay.
You want to draw the blood specifically.
That's what all the kings say. but honestly, that's something I remember contemporaneously we were talking about, like, could she have, like, a howitzer come out of there?
Yeah.
An M1 Abrams, an aircraft carrier? Like, you know, Tushek, could she give shadow twins? Like, what's the limitations? And, you know, like, a lot of magical systems, there aren't any until the author establishes them. And, you know, Martin, for good or ill, keeps this very mysterious. We don't get very many POV insights into Melisandre and what she's thinking and feeling, and very even fewer of guys like the Faceless Men and the Warlocks of Karth, and to know, like, how much of their shit is flim-flam and how much of it's true blue. We know it's, like, with Melisandre, it's a mixture of both. So it's still kind of up in the air. Sean K. For the longest time, I was convinced Jaime's going to kill Cersei and fulfill the Valonqar prophecy so often discussed on the podcast. But at the end of Season 7, with him riding away from King's Landing as it started to snow, it's led me to believe that this may never occur. I do think that Jaime will fight in a great war against the White Walkers and will very likely die in the process, but I think he will be the one to actually kill the Ice Dragon. We've already seen Jaime having the balls or the stupidity to try to charge a Drogon, but I also like the symmetry this brings to other storylines with him. As we learned earlier, that the story of Jaime as the Kingslayer is misunderstood and was in fact a very selfless act, saving thousands from wildfire at the expense of his honor. Since the Mad King was a Targaryen, Jaime's already a quote-unquote Dragon Slayer. I think that Jaime will find an opportunity to attack the Ice Dragon and the Night King's Rider, and will successfully kill the dragon, likely with his sword Oathkeeper. The Night King will survive and fight and eventually kill Jaime, but his intervention somehow saves Jon Snow and the others from being killed. This will fulfill Jaime's arc, which started in Season 1 as a rich, selfless asshole, to become one who embodies the true values of a knight. The most satisfying things about this theory would be, after it all happens, maybe with Sam telling his whole story Frodo Baggins style years later, they reference the book of all those in the Kingsguard and their list of achievements, with Jaime's page being filled out with some badass dragon slaying instead of just being the Kingslayer. I love that because, fuck you, Joffrey, there is still time. Which is the quote that Jaime said when Joffrey's making fun of his very short chapter in the Book of the Kingsguard. I don't normally read, like, these kind of theories, but I thought that there was a little bit of, like, textual and narrative meat to these bones.
Yeah,
what do you
think? That's the context in which we usually talk about Jaime, is the narrative impact that different events would happen.
Right. Now, I don't think these are mutually exclusive. I think he could be the Dragon Slayer and kill his sister as well. But I do like the idea that since he's already kind of slain a Targaryen, a dragon, and there was this jab at, like, oh, you just don't have any great works in your book yet, and him saying there's still time, that's a pretty good arc.
I just don't know how he's going to get to the dragon. The blue eyes white dragon. I don't know. Like, is it going to be sitting on the ground? Because John's got dibs on that second dragon, I hate to tell you. The only other available dragon is going to be ridden by John. So I don't know where he's going to get a sky-faring apparatus.
Well, the dragon might, like, land on the ground, similar to what happened with Danny. Now, that dragon was, like, wounded.
I don't know how you wound an
undead
dragon.
Yeah, it seems like
dragon.
You either hit him with a Valyrian spear or a obsidian spear, and it just burst into snowflakes, or...
He's invincible.
Yeah, you hit him with a spear, and he just doesn't even care because he's dead.
Right.
But I like...
Sneak up on him.
I like the...
drinking.
right. I like the narrative. I like the narrative mechanics of the theory. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good. Brad W. I've been trying to figure out why Ned never told Kat about the truth regarding John. I've tried to understand this, but can't figure it out. Can he not trust his wife with the truth? Why would he allow her to think that he was unfaithful and allow her to treat John that way, knowing it would be different if he just knew the truth? I understand not telling John because children don't keep secrets very well, but not his own wife?
He's got to betray someone in this scenario, right? If he doesn't tell Catelyn, he's sort of betraying her. Mm-hmm. He's proving that he doesn't trust her quite as much as he could. But if he does tell her, he's betraying his dead sister, right?
Right.
So he's stuck. I feel like Ned does not have a good operating mode coming out of this.
Yeah, I mean,
this promise to tell no one.
Yeah, like any average person, you, me, everybody, would probably tell their wife because...
I think so, yeah.
Otherwise...
Especially once the sister is dead.
Right.
Because betraying her is like, okay.
Right.
But I trust this person enough that they will not say anything.
But we're not talking about an average person. We're talking about fucking Ned Stark here, who I don't think saw any way to square that lie. Like... promise me, Ned, that you'll keep this kid safe. If there's a chance that Kat would betray, or even subconsciously, like the fact that Kat, there's a friction there, sells this lie.
It does.
And that lie keeps John safe from not just like, you know, whoever would want a Targaryen, but, you know, Robert Baratheon hates all Targaryens and would, like, I don't know that Ned thinks that he could stop him if he knew that he was actually the legitimate son of Rhaegar Targaryen. So having Kat be such a shit to Jon is a little bit of armor for him.
What about Hallen Reed?
What about him?
So Hallen Reed is like the wild
card. Sure he exists. He might just be a figment of Ned's imagination at this point.
Seriously, he was in the scene with him, so I seriously doubt it.
Ned was high on Poppy.
He knows. He knows about Jon Snow's parentage. So he wasn't in the Tower of Joy as far as I saw. I only saw Ned climb those stairs.
Right.
So Ned must have come down and told him, right?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any textual evidence that Howland Reed knows
that he actually that,
like,
knows.
Like, people think that, like, as the only survivors of the Tower of Joy and the close relationship that Howland Reed had to Ned going back to their children days.
That's fucked up, though.
Why?
Now you're saying, you're really going to tell me that the relationship between Ned and Howland is more beloved to him than the relationship between him and Catelyn?
Well, I'm not, because, again, I don't know that... I mean, it's always been like a speculation of like, well, who could possibly know the secret of John, and like Howland was there,
sure,
and
yeah,
he was close friends with. But you're right.
That,
like,
is speculative.
There, and I, as far as I know, there's not anything where it hints that, like, absolutely Howland knew the truth.
Okay. Maybe he didn't tell Howland. Maybe he just comes down with this baby. And
right.
Howland's like, what the fuck?
I mean, obviously in the show, I mean, I think it's telling that, I mean.
And he goes, I banged somebody. I was up there for a while.
Right.
It's been about 9 months, Howland.
Well, so there's the, that's why he can't, because
yeah, he can't,
he's got a baby.
Right. He comes down those stairs with a baby, and Howland's like, where'd you get that baby?
I think it's pretty certain that Howland probably knows, because he had to.
He had to, yeah.
Whereas his wife, he's been gone for almost a year on this campaign, and he comes back and he's got this baby.
Right.
So he can lie. He can lie to protect John with it. With Howland, you can't. So, like I said, it's brutal, and it's not something I think that you're designed to understand or sympathize with, but he spends a lot of the story telling you how fucking pigheaded and how seriously Ned takes promises and vows. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Especially the dying sisters, you know, like that just like, you know, the most important vow a person can take in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. It's not that I don't think she trusts Kat. It's more of, you know, he just is desperate to, because how could he ever forgive himself if something he did allowed John's identity to be got out and then Robert has him killed, or he has to go to war against Robert to protect. I mean, there's nothing good can come of John's identity being revealed.
There are a lot of reasons not to.
I think
a lot of reasons to tell her.
I think that's one of the reasons where Ned says to John, like, you know, we'll talk about your mother when I get back. Because in that context, the one thing that could save John is being at the wall. You know, that, like, and no, everyone respects the fact that, you know, when you take the vows, you give up any kind of claim on the throne. Because, shit, there's already a Targaryen up there, Aemon.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like that Ned thinks that if he got that, he could say, like, hey, by the way, you have, I mean, he could tell him the whole truth and he would be beyond everyone's wrath. I've always wondered what that conversation would be like, though, because you know, John's like, well, thanks for telling me, not dad. I'm stuck here at the wall. Maybe I wanted to go adventure and try to take back the, you know, what happens if, you know, imagine if Robert died and Joffrey's taking the throne. And he's a terrible king. Like, that'd probably stick in your craw, knowing that maybe you could have done better. And it was your throne, your rightful throne in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's all we got.
Okay.
GameofThrones@baldmove.com if you'd like to send in more feedback. Again, forums.baldmove.com if you'd like to check out that community, and you can also follow us all along on social media. Thanks for continuing the rewatch with us. We'll be back for the next episode next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.